From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we talk to undecided Wisconsin voters about their concerns ahead of the presidential election. Then, we'll hear from three generations of Latina organizers about why they're working to uplift their community.
You know, I was always raised with the idea of the campers rule, leave it better than how you found it. And I feel if we can simplify around those things in Milwaukee, we can be in so much different places.
Plus, a local nutrition educator shares advice to stay healthy in a new book.
The movement piece is try to get at least 22 minutes a day of what I call purposeful movement, where you're breathing a little more heavily, your heart rate's up a little bit more, and then 11 minutes of strength stretching or stability a day.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We're less than a month away from the presidential election, and in Wisconsin, a critical swing state, there are still some people who don't know who they'll vote for, or if they'll vote at all. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez talked to three undecided voters and has this story.
You work in radio, or you have a radio show? Please tell me about that.
So I work for WGLB, 1560 AM, 96.1 FM, where gospel lovers belong. So it's a gospel radio show that's on a radio station that's on 24/7.
This is Tynetta Jackson. She is full of energy and always asking questions, ideal qualities for a radio host. Her show on GLB is called Tea Time with Ty.
Today, topics was politics, of course, and politics when it relates to religion.
More specifically, she was talking about a disturbing trend she's seen from evangelical pastors, praying for the demise of Democratic candidates and the Democratic Party, something she says she could never do.
No matter what religion or faith you are, the biggest thing is love. Regardless if we have differences of what our opinions are or who we believe, I would never pray for demise of someone. And so that was what we were talking about. It's like, how can you have faith and love regardless if no matter who you are and what you believe, you don't wish harm to another person?
While today's topic got heavy, Tynetta called it a good show with lots of good listener feedback. The show is also an outlet for her to figure out how she'll vote in the November election as a still undecided voter.
I'm tired of the political ads, and we know that's the season of people, each candidate tearing each other down, the candidates tearing each other down. I want candidates to talk more about what you're going to do. What is the plan?
A recent Marquette poll found that 6% of Wisconsin voters are still undecided, including Tynetta. And she's not alone.
When it comes to the two candidates, I'm not really in love with either candidate. So from that standpoint, it's kind of a little bit up in the air. There's not a candidate that I'm particularly super excited about. And I think a lot of people feel that way, frankly.
This is Ken Dortzbach from Brookfield. He said he doesn't like Trump and has been historically unimpressed with Harris. He doesn't know if Harris would be four more years of Biden policy or be her own person.
It's a bit of a paradox because she's been in office for almost 4 years now. But in another sense, we're still just starting to get to meet her at the last moment.
While watching last month's presidential debate, he said he was looking for specifics from Harris.
Yeah, I'm voting kind of based upon the economy, but also foreign policy. And what are you actually going to do over the next 4 years? I'm very leery of platitudes and vague comments, and I'd like to see or hear the specifics that you're able to talk about in a debate. Again, in a debate, you can't get too specific, but they're specific and then they're specific, and you can kind of tell if someone doesn't have anything to back it up.
Tynetta has similar concerns. She also wants to know how candidates are reinforcing Social Security and senior benefits. She also wants someone to stop what's happening in Gaza and thinks both parties are enabling it, and that neither knows how to end it. In Wisconsin's spring primary, over 8% of Democratic voters voted uninstructed as a protest vote against Democrats enabling Israel's bombardment of Gaza. That's almost equal to Biden's margin of victory over Trump 4 years ago in the state. What are the issues that kind of like matter to you thinking about like national politics?
Right now, what I would tell people is that I'm a one-issue voter in this election. And that issue is ending the genocide in Gaza and stopping the spread of war into other countries like Lebanon.
This is Ron Jansen.
Second to that, obviously, is climate, immigration, and not in the way that other people talk about immigration. The racism and the xenophobia that we see from really everybody on both sides of the, you know, so-called aisle at this point is really gross.
Ron said it's not just presidential candidates that are doing this, but also Wisconsin's Senate race. He called Tammy Baldwin's ads anti-immigrant, a long cry from the same candidate who once championed the DREAM Act. Ron, like the other voters here, says he's tired. He's tired of being given two flawed candidates and being told to suck it up. He says he's tired of voting for the lesser of two evils. Look where that's gotten us.
And now I've watched Biden drag the whole country right in a slow and terrifying manner. And, you know, now we see the result of that in this next election.
Where does this all leave voters like Ron, Tynetta, or Ken? No political home to rally around, no policies to champion. And this is especially tough for someone like Tynetta, who's been working in voting advocacy for a long time. She knows how important it is for Black people to exercise their right to vote and how much it went into making that vote possible. And she says it's crushing when she meets people who don't use that power.
I've had a young man that said he never voted, his mother never voted, his grandmother never voted. So that was really sad to me that I'm like, are you serious? So no one in your household ever thought it was important to vote.
So we're talking today because of your kind of uncommitted stance on this election.
Right.
Like, how are you doing considering the fact that you know the power of the vote and how important it is to, like, make your voice heard?
Yeah.
What do you feel like this ballot is missing for you to, like, participate in?
I'm going to participate. I just don't know which way I'm leaning. I'm definitely going to exercise my vote.
Her candidates of choice right now are Jill Stein or Cornel West. She says that the organization she's a part of also don't feel heard from either political party, so maybe they should withdraw their vote until they feel heard or represented. While Ron says Harris could still get his vote if there is
an immediate arms embargo, no more shipments to Israel, an immediate cut in aid to Israel, and an immediate demand for ceasefire right now. Without that, Harris will not get my vote.
Currently, and realistically, he's also leaning third party.
My indecision is not between Trump or Harris. Trump is a non-starter, but at this point, Harris is also a non-starter for me. And so really what I'm undecided on is leaving the box blank or voting for Claudia and Karina, which are socialist candidates.
Jansen says he's had political allies call him out for some of his stances, and that he's even had people call him racist because he's been critical of Harris.
You know, that I'm somehow supporting Trump or that I don't want America to survive. And that's insane. Like, what I don't want to do is watch another 100,000 men, women, and children be murdered with my tax dollars.
Both Ron and Tynetta know what they could hear with their protest vote. You lost the election for Harris, or it's because of you that Trump won.
That's why I say I'm undecided, because that is where I'm torn. Because I know that I do not want Trump in office. I know that. So that is where I'm torn. That is truly where I'm torn, because I know that if he gets the majority, we're going to be living under a dictatorship. And I just do not want to live under that kind of environment, society, where he's coming after everyone and he's looking for everyone who voted against him.
With a month to go until the election, she says, as a praying woman, she'll pray on it.
That story was reported by Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez with help from WUWM's Mayan Silver. They spoke with undecided Wisconsin voters Tynetta Jackson, Ron Jansen, and Ken Dortzbach. Group Chat is our monthly series that passes the mic to local Milwaukeeans to talk with each other. This month is Latino Heritage Month, and we thought it would be a good time to hear from some longstanding and new Latino organizers here in Milwaukee. This conversation brought together three generations of Latino organizers, including Tammy Rivera, Drea Rodriguez, and Isabel Bella Smith. The three women have worked or currently work at Southside Organizing Center, or SOC. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez produced this conversation.
Yeah, so I'll start. I'm Drea Rodriguez. I'm a resident of Milwaukee lifelong. I'm currently the Global Program Officer for Women Serve. Previously, I worked at Southside Organizing Center, and I was so thankful to have a mentor in Tammy who's, you know, I know this is a generational conversation, but she's like my big sister in so many ways.
My name is Tammy Rivera. I'm the executive director and lead organizer at SOC, and I'm also the founder and principal consultant for Ejecutiva.
Hi, everyone. My name is Isabel Smith, and I'm a youth organizer at Southside Organizing Center.
You know, when Jimmy came with the idea of this conversation with me, I wouldn't be here without mentors like you, Tammy. Of course, we learn so much from our youth, so it was imperative to have a youth organizer here as well, and hoping to talk about, you know, our three generations and also the importance of mentorship.
With mentorship, I know that oftentimes youth my age misinterpret the meaning of assisting the community while also taking accountability of the actions that are being made or done. However, like working civic engagement, like allows kids to have a say what, when, how. Basically, I know it's hard to feel heard from an adult. There's like competition between what you have to say, and sometimes there's no solution. But like having an idea on what to push for can like lead you to success.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, too, like, there's so many things in our world where our personal lives are political against our will. And if we don't learn the systems that we're in, if we don't learn our history, you know, we're stuck here. And as, you know, a younger person right now, especially, you know, after COVID, it's becoming more imperative, the haves and the have-nots, you know, who's doing what. So, like, making sure that we're activating our young people and letting them know not only are they responsible for certain things, but they have certain rights as well. And I that's one thing that I'm so thankful for organizations like SOC, because they make that so clear for so many residents.
When I think of the youth and mentorship, what we have seen or observed in the program is mentorship even among them. So Bella is a lead youth in our youth program. We serve kids 14 through 18. And she's been with us for a little bit now. But you can see the transformation from the youth, for many of them, from the time they arrive. But it's beautiful to see Abella lead, nurture, and mentor her peers.
Yeah.
Bella, why did you want to be part of the youth organizer program? And how does that fit into what you wanted to happen in this season in your life and where you're going?
Okay, so I'd like to start off with saying that I was always the kid in elementary school that everybody would go to with their problems. Knowing that that could relate now to present society makes me feel devastated. I feel like my voice has power, especially being a child. When I found that I had a job opportunity to feel heard, I thought that maybe that could probably escalate the idea of it to other generations, other kids. Me being involved in my friends' problems, there's less of that going on. But however, knowing that I can feel heard by whether it's people my age or not, adults too, I think that that just made my leadership increase by a lot.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
The root of why I do what I do, it's twofold. First and foremost, it comes out of my faith, my Christian faith belief, which is, you know, love is an action. And if I love my fellow neighbors, I'm going to address their suffering, which includes oppression. So that's really the core of why my soul does what it does. And then I have I think about my earliest experience of being aware of and acting in a liberation mode. I was about 8. And my mom took me to the welfare office with her. We were very poor. For those of you who don't remember, they used to be able to turn off your heat mm-hmm. in Milwaukee. And we just thought that was normal. I don't know how we survived it. But anyway, she took me to the welfare office. But my mom was a very beautiful woman on the outside. And she was like very gregarious, happy-go-lucky. I'm a little spicier than my mom. And what I witnessed is when we got there, her whole demeanor changed. And I didn't have the words for it then. But I saw her look ashamed and afraid. And I really hadn't seen that combination in my mom. And it was so drastic that I felt like really disoriented, like what's going to happen? And we had a rough household. So we were used to like what's going to happen. But it was very different. When we went into the office, there was a social worker. It was a white female, older. And she was really cruel and ugly with my mom. And I was shocked because I didn't know where to put that. And I remember standing up and telling her, don't talk to my mom like that. And I was like livid as a little girl and was like, you feeling protective of her and like offended. And of course, my mom hushed me. She never did take me back to the welfare office with her neither. That was my first experience. And what really hits me is not 10 years later, my mom died very young. She was 39. And I think about the opportunity that woman had to make a difference in my mom's life. My mom was very hopeless. And she used her power to attack someone in a vulnerable position. And as I got older, I kept processing that situation. And I remember thinking, if my mom wasn't on welfare, that lady wouldn't have a job. So who's the welfare recipient? You know, you start processing it differently. And I process it maybe if she would have been helpful, that could have helped my mom and she'd still be alive because she left us all teenagers orphans. And that's really the two reasons that I do what I do.
You know, for my story, I feel like it has been a lot of like reinvention over and over again so many times. So being born a first generation American on the north side of Milwaukee, you know, there was a lot of times where I found myself in situations where I had questions like, why is this happening? Or, you know, my mother's a factory worker. My dad is owning a business. I had questions always. I would see chaos in my neighborhood. I had questions. I was not a quiet child. And while I was told to be quiet more than I wanted, you know, it was something that was always naturally curious about myself that I kept. And being a lifelong learner, you know, and eventually becoming an educator. Thankfully, I graduated from Alverno, barely did that because of, you know, I didn't have any resources. Neither of my parents graduated high school. They didn't know exactly how to help guide me into a college situation. So, you know, I depended a lot on so many people. And along the way, I learned a lot about not only the systems and the red tape, but how liberation, like the goal here is liberation. I don't want equity anymore. I don't want just equality. I want liberation. I want the fence gone. And being an educator, feeling stuck, like there were so many times where I was there at 7 o'clock at night with a baby on my hip in an ergo, tutoring parents so they could help their own child with homework. And, you know, I could bang myself on the head doing that. And I realized I could be more effective as a change agent if I did work with community directly. So there was a time in my life where, you know, I had a daughter that was 8 months old when my mother died. And in that same year, it changed my life drastically where I realized that if I continue to do these things, I'm going to pass away just like my mother did, just like her mother did. And, you know, it just, I don't want that for my daughter. So really taking what I had and applying it to what I could be doing with community work. And by chance, I got to meet Tammy. Again, I had questions, and I'm always asking questions. Tammy knows this. I always have a question to ask. I want to know answers. And because, you know, God gifted me with that ability, let me help let it be beneficial to my entire neighborhood when possible. Adding on to that, you know, I was always raised with the idea of the camper's rule, leave it better than how you found it. And I feel if we can simplify around those things in Milwaukee, we can be in so much different places. But again, it's making sure that the stakeholders, the residents, are heard first.
I would like to say when joining SOC, I felt like I already knew everybody around me. However, my brother was a worker here before, and I felt that there's a little bit of competition. You can do all this stuff around the house, but I can get out there and do it myself. So I'd say, like, knowing that I'm doing better than him. So I think that kind of pushed me to communicate more. I'm a sheltered kid. I know that there are opportunities for me out there. I just have a hesitant take on it. But just for an example, just on my birthday, July 10th, I was speaking in front of the aldermen with confidence. I had to say a speech. So I'd say having opportunities like that really pushed me.
Beautiful.
I will say I do have a question for either one who wants to answer.
Yes.
What are some things that adults look for in children? I know that with today's generation, it's hard to find someone who's actually willing to strive as much as a civic engagement youth would. But what exactly do adults look for?
First and foremost is for a young person to feel loved, to feel safe, and to be treasured.
My number one for everyone, especially our youth, is for you to feel safe. You know, when you feel safe, you're able to see your potential and your growth. And, you know, so many of us, Tammy and I alike, you know, we had, you know, young lives that we were not told about the resources out there. We were not told what we were capable of doing. The narrative was quite different. Just, you know, be at home, stay out of trouble, you know, be seen and not heard. You know, and now we want so much different for our youth now. We want you safe so you can thrive and have your own power and realize your power.
Thank you.
Can I add one more statement about the generation above us?
Yeah, please do.
When we're talking about Latino organizing or organizing in general, I want to give a shout out to the generations before us. Of course, all the way back to our ancestors, we're here as a testimony to how resilient our people are despite the attacks and very intentional genocide and oppression that has occurred. But in particular, I want to thank Carmen Cabrera, who's been my mentor. I consider her the most knowledgeable and experienced person in the civic organizing, in addition to she has been involved in activism and organizing. Mm-hmm. She was a teenager when the Chapman Hall of UWM was taken over by Latinos. She was a teenager, Bella, in that protest to ensure that Spanish-speaking and Latinos are represented at the university. But a great amount of credit goes to people like Carmen, who were present during the civil rights movement. And they paid some bigger prices than we did and had a lot more on the line. And also, organizing wasn't a profession then. So I just want to extend my love and appreciation and respect for Carmen and the rest of our leaders who paved the way for us and then continued to mentor us as we became professional Latino organizers. And speaking to the importance of Latino organizing, I often give testimony that the color brown is invisible in the city. Which is not wise, even if you're not going to do it for liberation, mm-hmm. for equity, for people to not understand the impact the Latino has in this local community and the state and the nation. And so it's critical that we expand Latino organizing because we're not seen, we're not honored in the levels that we need to be, and also we're the number one minority in the state. Huge impact on the nation economically, culturally. We're just now creeping our numbers up in representation, formal representation, like elected, but it's really past due. And it's not in anybody's benefit to keep the Latinos down. It's not in anybody's benefit.
Just the oxymoron, though, of number one minority. And also, the division amongst Latinos and the way race, you know, that is a human aid concept, not mm-hmm. our humans, but we know that that was put upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we keep a global perspective, we are stronger. And there is natural division amongst our people so much. And this election right now is proving that the division is happening. So I just think also the importance of us is making sure that we're united sooner, because the systems are made up to keep us separate, keep us down, not for us to realize that we are our own best resource. Tammy, is there still plans for Southside Organizing Center to do some type of like museum or pace to give, you know, we need to learn our history, like a space just for us?
Yeah, I can't reveal anything, but stay tuned, mi gente.
Stay tuned.
Mi gente, we're waiting on news that would allow SOC to do just that. And I don't want to give too much away, but hey, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn.
Yes, absolutely.
That was Tammy Rivera, Drea Rodriguez, and Isabel Bella-Smith. This month's group chat was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll delve into the history of the former professional football team, the Milwaukee Badgers. But first, we'll learn about some simple steps that could help lead to lifelong wellness. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Susie Kundrat has taught students in the fields of kinesiology and nutritional sciences for decades at UW-Milwaukee. Through teaching, she's learned that the best way to share information was often to simplify the science. This experience as a nutrition educator and health advocate inspired Kundrat to launch Eat, Move, Groove, a book and a tour that shares simple and positive ways to improve one's health, no matter your age or your physical ability. Kundrat will be in Shorewood for her latest tour stop, but before that, she joins me to share more.
There's so many wonderful things that we can teach people, and we can help people get moving and eat well and take care of their well-being, but there wasn't what I would consider a simple solution for that. And so as I started thinking about what I could do to make a difference in that space for consumers, I came up with the idea of Eat, Move, Groove, simple ways to eat, move your body in ways that feel good to you, and support your personal well-being in all kinds of ways, which is what I talk about with the groove.
You know, when you break it down like that, it's kind of like, oh, why don't we think of it this way? But there's been such a long history of the difficulty of bridging that gap between what we know we should do right and how to actually implement it.
Yes, yes. And I love your term bridging the gap, because when I speak to groups all over the country now, I talk a lot about finding that bridge over what might have been a very difficult river to pass, and let's simplify that, and let's keep it positive, and of course, let's ground it in solid science. And because we know there are so many programs and books and things out there that really aren't grounded in solid science. In fact, the other day I was interviewed about the 3-day sardine diet, and you know, there are still crazy things like that that are out there that are popular. So really looking at how we can bridge all the research, but put it into a package that people can do, that they can remember, and they can feel good about. That was really my goal.
Let's touch upon some of the things that still exist. You mentioned a sardine diet, which I've never heard of, but what are the dangers of these themed programs?
Well, I would say the first danger is it's something people go on and then they go off. So even if someone might lose a few pounds in a short period of time, which let's face it, if you ate mostly beets or cabbage or sardines or whatever it might be for a short period of time, you're not going to be able to eat that much of it. So you may lose a little bit of water weight, and you may lose, you know, you may feel a little leaner, a little lighter in the short term. But of course, that's not true changes in your body. And so these on again, off again programs, what they do is they kind of set us up to feel bad. Or, of course, on the longer period, we're concerned about nutrient deficiencies or people actually getting sick from them, passing out, not feeling good. So there's all kinds of physical problems that can happen from that too. And I would say even plans that are just too restrictive, they might be somewhat balanced in the diet, but either they're too restrictive or they limit the number of hours you can eat to the point where people don't feel good. So any kind of restriction that is unnecessary is something that we really need to take a close look at. And so my goal with Eat, Move, Groove is to put something out there that is fun, it's simple, it's, I wouldn't say it's easy to do because any behavior change is not necessarily easy, but it has a formula that people can go back to every day. They don't have to think about yesterday, did I do this, did I not do this? But it's easy enough to understand that people can do it and feel good about it.
So really honing in on accessibility, being able to do it day-to-day, positivity, keeping it simple. So can you kind of break down some of the main concepts around, say, how you eat and how you move and kind of laying out that plan for us?
Right. Well, the EAT plan is based on the idea of 2-2-1-1, or what I call the 22-11, which is simply just thinking, when you start a meal, try to start it with the first two. And the first two is 2 cups of produce, fruits or vegetables. It might be canned, it might be fresh, it might be a glass of orange juice as one of them. But try to get 2 cups of produce, anything you like, doesn't have to be a certain kind. And the second two is at least 2 ounce equivalents of protein. That might be, the 2 ounces of produce might look like 2 baseball or pickleball sizes. The 2 ounces of protein might be something like a tennis ball, which is equivalent to about a half a cup of, say, chopped chicken breast. Or in the book I talk about, that equals around 15 grams of protein on a nutrition facts label. So you start with a 22. And the reason for that is because we know, we have so much research to indicate that if we will find a way to eat more produce consistently, then that is so protective for us. It's so protective. It really leads to lower risk of disease and enhanced lifespan. So that produce piece is important. But most of my work through the years at UW-Milwaukee and other places has been focused on maintaining strength and lean mass and our muscle mass. And so that protein piece is just as important. So I say at least 2 ounces of protein at a meal. Those needs are based on body weight and our exercise, and I can get into that. But a minimum of having protein at every meal, I believe, is so important. And so that's the other 2 ounces. So that's the 22. And then the 11 is 1-1, one whole grain or starch, like a potato or slice of whole grain toast like we had this morning, and one healthy fat source. That might be a little olive oil or half an avocado or a handful of nuts or something like that, because the whole grain is important and the fat is also important. So that's the 22 with produce and protein, it's the 11 with a grain or starch and a healthy fat source.
Now, how about the movement component? Because a lot of people would assume, hey, I gotta up the ante here. I need to spend 1 class a day at a gym somewhere. Or, you know, we have these indicators that we set for ourselves of what is, quote unquote, a good workout.
Yes, well, it's really interesting. And when I was doing a lot of the research around this. I mean, my background is a registered dietitian. I know a lot about movement and exercise, but I'm not an exercise physiologist per se. But I worked with people like Ann Schwartz at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Dr. Laura Rooney, who's at Marquette, Carol Kennedy was at Indiana, and these experts in exercise. And I remember one conversation I had with Ann at UW-Milwaukee, and we were talking about this, and she said, well, it fits perfectly because if you take those national guidelines for exercise, 150 minutes a week of what we'd call cardiovascular or movement where we get our heart rate up, divide that down, that's about 22 minutes a day. So the movement piece is try to get at least 22 minutes a day of what I call purposeful movement, where you're breathing a little more heavily, your heart rate's up a little bit more, and then 11 minutes of strength stretching or stability a day. And if we take those national guidelines for strength, 30 minutes twice a week of a strength type routine, divide that down, I call that about 11 minutes of strength, stretching, or stability a day. So what people need to remember is the 20 to 11 for eat and the 20 to 11 for move. And as Anne often says, you find what brings you joy, and that's the type of movement you do. So it's very positive. And the other piece about the eat that I forgot to mention is that aside from the 20 to 11, I talk a lot about love foods, which is including foods you just love to eat, even if it's not something we would consider healthy. So you might enjoy a glass of wine or an old fashioned, or you might enjoy a piece of chocolate or something. And there's room for that because it's important that we eat things we enjoy.
Now, speaking of moving, you've been doing a different kind of movement all across the country. You've been on a book tour. And I'm curious about how this experience has been different or maybe similar to some of the interactions you're used to having in a classroom with your students.
Yes. Well, I've been really fortunate to be on this trip in our camper van with my wife, Audrey, and we have been traveling all around the Northeast for the last month. And we're doing a mix of things. We're landing at a lot of different universities, working with students, training students on the Eat, Move, Groove program. And that's been really, really fun because, of course, I love teaching and I miss my full-time teaching. So that's great. And then we're working with all kinds of groups. We're working with senior centers. We're working with fitness centers. We are going around talking to small groups and larger groups of people. And it really seems to be resonating with people because they like the idea that, wow, you've really simplified this research in a way that I can understand, first of all, and I feel good about, and it's inclusive. I was just at Bradley University the other day, and several of their students came up to me afterwards and said, I love the fact that no matter what your background is, no matter what foods you like, no matter how you cook or don't cook, no matter how you like to move your body, this plan can work for everyone. So that was one of my goals. That's a passion of mine, is to what I call provide an invitation to well-being for everyone.
Now, I want to talk about something that the widespread diet and exercise programs get wrong or just totally don't consider, and that's access. You know, food and nutrition security is a hurdle that people who have the fortunate regular access to don't often think about. So how are you being mindful of this throughout your program as well?
Yes. Well, one of the ways is to make sure people understand no matter what kind of food you eat, there's a big push against processed food right now. And I'm pushing back against that because processing in many ways for many kinds of food can actually not be negative, can be helpful. For example, canned peaches or processed peaches, and they're very good and they might be more accessible at a food pantry, for example. And so making sure people understand it might be canned, frozen, fresh, dried, juice, however you like it, and however you find those foods to be accessible to you, include them in your plan. So that's one important thing. And I also think that it's very important for us, wherever we are on this trip, we've made a commitment to donating 22%, everything's based on 22, of profits from book sales back to the local communities, to food pantries and food banks and food assistance programs on college campuses all around in the community, because we believe part of that is there's not enough access to good, healthy food. And, you know, at the core of my being, I certainly believe, and my wife does too, that everyone deserves good, healthy food. And so we've made a commitment to that. So we've been meeting people all around the country who are working in food security, nutrition security too. But I think one thing is when we simplify the messaging, when we invite everyone to say, you don't have to go to a gym, you don't have to pay for this, you don't have to belong somewhere here, you can go up and down your stairs, you can go outside and walk around your block if you're able to, you might be in a chair, and there are things you can do in a chair if you have limitations. And so that was very important to me. So, and we're getting some wonderful feedback on that too.
Excellent. Well, Susie, thank you so much for joining me to share more.
Thank you.
Susie Kundrat is a clinical professor emerita at UW-Milwaukee and the owner of Eat, Move, Groove. She'll be at Shorewood High School tomorrow evening as a part of the Eat, Move, Groove Wellness Tour, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. So submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. It's football season, so it's time to learn about the Badgers. The Milwaukee Badgers, that is. Learn more about one of the first pro football teams next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This football season, we're looking back at a Wisconsin professional football team not quite as well known as the Packers. The Milwaukee Badgers were one of the first pro football teams in the U.S., but the franchise was short-lived. Historian Matthew Prigge wrote about the team for Milwaukee Magazine, and he joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
We're talking about the early days of the NFL. In fact, so early that it wasn't actually called the NFL at the time. Things were very different. What was football like at that time in the early 20s?
Well, professional football was kind of a niche sport, really. The college game had been very popular since the turn of the century. That's where most of the national fan attention was. The game itself was, you know, growing in popularity, nothing like baseball or boxing back in those days. But for the professional game, in a lot of places, it not only trailed behind college football, but also just, you know, high school football, local company teams would often draw more than the pro clubs would. And the NFL, or what became the NFL, was really pretty small regionally. It was mostly the Midwest, a little bit into the East Coast as well. But it was it was a struggling sport, and it was fairly easy to get into pro football back then from a, you know, a management standpoint.
I was surprised by just how many cities in the Midwest had their own teams. So, of course, Milwaukee gets this team in 1922. Green Bay already existed. What were some of the other cities in the area that had teams at the time?
So in 1922, when the Badgers, the Milwaukee Badgers, debuted in the NFL, there were also teams in Racine, Canton, Ohio, Hammond, Indiana, Rock Island, Dayton, Akron. These places all had pro football teams and, you know, operated to varying degrees of success. Green Bay was one of the more successful teams. They were able to cultivate a pretty solid fan base, but a lot of these other cities had trouble maintaining attention. In fact, at the time Milwaukee joined the league, they were actually the third largest city in pro football at that time.
Now, one of the surprising things about the Milwaukee team itself, there were a number of Black players on the team at a time when we really don't think about sports teams especially being racially integrated. Was that unusual for a team to be integrated, or was football itself fairly integrated?
Well, I don't know if I'd go as far as it was fairly integrated, but there were a number of Black players who played in the early days. And I think part of the part of that was due to the NFL's sort of under the radar status. You know, it didn't have the prestige of the American League or National League for baseball, and it was a little easier to integrate these pro football teams, rather, just because things were so kind of on the margins. But the Badgers did early on have not only a number of African-American players, but some African-Americans who were pretty big stars. Fritz Pollard, a back, was one of their early stars. He ended up being inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. They also had an end by the name of Paul Robeson, who would later go on to achieve fame as a civil rights activist and singer, one of the key figures of the Harlem Renaissance. There has been some speculation that Pollard even served as the team's head coach for a time. This is the head coach position back then was nothing like it would be considered today. It was each team had a head coach that was also a player. It was just sort of a team captain, I think would be a more apt correspondent for that today. But there are some who credit Pollard as being the first African-American coach in American professional sports.
You know, this idea that the coaches were also players, that things were in a lot of ways more informal, I think really speaks to this moment in professional football history. Now, things at the NFL are so formal. Everything has its own kind of organization. There's organizations within the organization of said organizations. At the time, it seems like things were, I don't want to say haphazard, but there weren't a standard number of games. It seems like people just kind of scheduled with people when they wanted to. How does the game at that time compare to the kind of pomp and circumstance we see today?
Right. Yeah, things were a lot more informal back then. Teams did not have set schedules. The league did not create a schedule for the teams. They were just able to set up as many games as they wanted to with other teams in the league. There was no championship game. In fact, the championship was awarded by a vote of the team owners a few months after the season would end. I think it always went to the team that ended up with the best record, but there was no requirement to do that. So, you know, and especially with some of the fringe clubs, again, those teams that couldn't really draw a good fan base, things got very, very informal. Some teams would play four games in a season. If they're a particularly lousy team, they couldn't find anybody to play. They would just disband. Maybe they'd show up again the next year. Maybe they wouldn't. One of the owners of the Badgers, actually, there's a story of him suiting up for a game. Not playing, just to give the opposing team the impression that they had more players on the bench. It was very much a game-to-game operation back then.
It seems at the time as well, everything about it was incredibly working class. The audiences were a working class audience. Football fans who would have been maybe white collar would be more interested in college football at the time. The players and even the owners were blue collar, and to some extent, that seems to lead to the demise of the Milwaukee Badgers. They continue to deal with just a lack of money.
Yeah. In fact, Sunday being the pro football day is rooted in that. Of course, Saturday is what we know as college football day. And that was kind of based on the ideal that people, alumni of these colleges, had white collar jobs and would have Saturdays off. So they could come out and watch the game or listen on the radio once that got going. But pro football on Sunday was a specific decision to appeal to working people who probably got one day a week off. But yeah, the team itself, again, very, very working class, very blue collar. A lot of the players had other jobs during the season or certainly after the season. The idea of practicing all week wasn't something that existed then. Most of the time they would show up on Sunday and play and then go home and work whatever else they did, whatever other job they had throughout the week. Even the team's owners, they both had laboring jobs. But yeah, there was a definite lack of money with the Badgers to keep, because I mentioned some of the talented players they had, but they weren't able to retain those players. And with no real continuity from year to year, it was tough to build up a fan base. And of course, the Packers being so close didn't help with that either. They were never really able to compete with the Packers on the field or financially. You know, their owners had so long hoped to build up a rivalry with Green Bay that could, you know, if they played two games with the Packers over a season, that could kind of sustain the rest of the season and generate interest. But they were just never able to keep up. The people in the league at that time, no one expected them to fail. They all expected that, you know, as the league began moving towards larger cities to try to establish itself as a major sports league, they knew they needed big cities like Milwaukee. They eventually thought that Green Bay would kind of fall by the wayside, and all of the other smaller town teams, you know, Racine, etc., all those teams ended up failing as the league moved into larger markets, but it ended up being Green Bay, the one that was being the one that managed to survive. And there, you know, if there's any historical significance of the Badgers, it's probably in the Packers, that they were the one small town team who was able to survive and prosper to this day.
Beat the odds. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Oh, of course. Always a pleasure.
Matthew Prigge is a local historian and a librarian who wrote about the Milwaukee Badgers for Milwaukee Magazine. His conversation with Lake Effect's Joy Powers was recorded in 2022. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll head to Mamie's on Milwaukee's South Side and learn about the best dive bars in the city. Plus, we'll tell you about a program in Milwaukee that's cutting down on food waste. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.